A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is sponsored by BT, because BT means business. BT knows that businesses come in many shapes, sizes, and guises, from the person just starting out at their kitchen table to the biggest employer, which is why no matter what line of work you're in, they've got your back to help you succeed and do what you do best. No doubt connectivity is a must in Westminster, and it certainly helped us to get this episode created and distributed to you listening right now. BT already connects more than 1 million businesses and public sector organisations, offering secure and reliable connectivity. Nearly three quarters of people running a business or side hustle feel they couldn't do so without reliable broadband and mobile connectivity. That's why having connectivity you can count on is a must for business, whether it be facilitating multiple devices being connected at once, or making team calls or guest Wi-Fi access for customers. BT's connectivity helps keep you and your customers happy. Whatever your business, BT's got your back. Search BT's got your back.
Hello, and welcome to the Red Box Politics Podcast in the Times. I'm Matt Chorley. What's the greatest political movie ever? It was a question prompted by a message from Red Box podcast listener Tom Barnaby, who suggested we did an episode on political films. So I turned to readers of the Red Box morning email and Twitter to ask people to nominate their favourite political films. In only a few hours, we had more than 700 suggestions covering 250 different films. Later in the episode, we'll speak to Kevin Mayer, the Times' chief film critic, and he'll tell us the ones which really are worth watching and the ones that are best avoided. But as we had so many entries, and frankly, we've not got anything else worth doing, we're going to run a World Cup of political films on Twitter. If you're listening to this episode on Friday, March the 27th, from 10 a.m, we will begin the group stages of the top 32 films that you all recommended, and you can follow its progress throughout the day. Just go to Times Red Box on Twitter, so that's twitter.com/TimesRedBox. And you can follow the polls and the contest as it unfolds to see which film comes out on top. But first, because it's Friday, it's time to check in with Red Box reporter Esther Webber, who I haven't seen now for about 2 weeks. How are you doing, Esther?
I'm doing all right, thank you. Last week when we spoke, I was feeling a bit poorly, but I seem to be fine now. So even if I did have something, I think it's passed.
Well, there'll definitely be a test to find that out, either in the next day, the next week, the next month, or the next year, depending on which public health body you believe. And how are you finding, you know, is your exercise bike arrived, the rowing machine?
No rowing machine, but I think we'll stick with the exercise bike for now. But I have to say it has been an enormous help. I think it's just good to sort of feel like you're doing something with your body apart from sitting around all day staring at a screen. I mean, I'm not the most kind of fanatical about exercise, but I think it really has helped. But I can see exactly what's going to happen, which is that if and when this is lifted, I'll probably never do it again.
Well, I was thinking about that. So I've, at the risk of being all smug, because I'll never do this again, I've done a 3-mile run every day this week.
Oh, wow.
It's the most exercise I think I've ever done. And I did my fastest 5K this morning. So it's all going very well. But you're totally right. Part of me is thinking, well, when we go back to normal, do I keep this up? Yeah. Or do I just think, I remember when I used to go running.
I did notice that since Boris Johnson told us about our one allotted exercise session a day, I've noticed a lot more joggers going past the window.
Yeah, well, interesting thing. Will they be there next week? That's the big question. As you mentioned, Boris Johnson, and this is supposedly a political podcast, we just touch on what has happened in Parliament this week, which is they've all packed up and left. Parliament has officially, they've just broken up for the Easter recess a bit early. In reality, they've packed up for at least 4 weeks, possibly longer, leaving us with sort of even less in the way of politics to sort of keep an eye on.
It's bizarre because they were under pressure for a long time to close down, given Parliament obviously brings a large number of people who've been travelling around the country into proximity together. And the government obviously argued they needed to stay open to pass the key bit of coronavirus legislation this week. And then we had the spectacle of PMQs this week, Jeremy Corbyn's last PMQs. And that was it, basically. It sort of feels like a rather strange and muted end to what has been, by any measure, quite a tumultuous time in charge of the Labour Party.
Yeah, exactly. The sort of the farewell to Jeremy Corbyn was as low-key and uninteresting as so much of his leadership. And when Boris Johnson tried to say something nice to him and sort of paid tribute, he said, we might not always agree on things, but, you know, no one could doubt your sincerity for trying to do the right thing. Completely threw Jeremy Corbyn, didn't know what to do with that at all. So Parliament is packed up. I was struck just before it did, Lindsay Hoyle, the Commons Speaker, made a statement in the House talking about the idea of the Commons sort of meeting virtually, yeah. Whether it's the Commons Chamber or Select Committee and that sort of thing. And he ended up making an appeal to Downing Street, because apparently Downing Street has got a security licence, which would basically mean the technology was secure for MPs to carry out their business remotely. Downing Street's got a licence and Parliament hasn't. And he was wondering if maybe Downing Street would essentially share their login so that they could have a virtual Parliament and virtual sittings.
It would seem sensible, wouldn't it? I mean, the fact that we've had virtual committee sittings this week does beg the question of why it hasn't ever been tried before. And I think some people will be asking the same questions about electronic voting and other forms of remote working in Parliament that we've always been told would bring about the death knell of democracy.
And yeah, and actually it turns out that when needs must, they can probably make it work. You've been looking at what happened in Parliament the last time the entire world was in the grip of a pandemic.
Yeah, because this is the kind of thing I like doing. I was having a look back at the Hansard from 1918, when obviously the world was dealing with another global pandemic in the form of influenza, or Spanish flu, as it was known. The main fascinating thing I found was that it didn't really seem to dominate Parliament in the way that coronavirus is doing right now. And there were a load of different reasons for that. It was partly to do with the fact that they were still dealing with the end of the First World War, and also somewhat different approach to Parliament in general, where it was kind of more of a gentlemanly approach, where people sort of asked their questions, received their answers, and then went away in an orderly fashion to think about it. It wasn't the same kind of constant hammering away. So from that, I did a bit more reading about the political climate of the time, and it was really interesting to see the extent to which people were kind of basically told to ignore what was going on, and that if they paid too much attention or got too frightened, it would increase their chances of getting sick.
Well, that's, you know, that's a sort of, yeah. If you were only, we were just more positive about the virus, it would all go away.
Yeah, that really is what they said. And a lot of doctors at the time were very critical of the press for supposedly whipping people up into a frenzy about it. They didn't even want newspapers to try and report the number of deaths. But at the same time, there were local authorities and individual politicians trying to change the picture and meet the challenge. And that did lead to, for example, the formation of the Department for Health. So it did achieve some good in the end.
Did Parliament carry on sitting? I mean, they were that relaxed about it. Presumably they were all sitting shoulder to shoulder and just carried on as normal.
Yep, there was no change in that since Lloyd George actually got it himself at one point. And he converted the whole of the front of Manchester Town Hall into a kind of infirmary for his convalescence.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Well, we look forward to Boris Johnson doing similar and everyone thinking that that was absolutely fine. You've written about that for the Red Box email out today, Friday, so people can read more on that either in the email or on thetimes.co.uk. Just finally, before we move on and speak to Kevin Mayer, we're talking political films. Have you got a favourite political film?
So I thought of a couple. I think one of them has come up quite a lot, and that is In the Loop. It's obviously a brilliant film from Armando Iannucci and the whole thick of it, Stable. I think the bit I really, one of my favourite things about that film is not only all the stuff when they're in America and they're trying to haphazardly blunder into this war scenario, but I love the fact that while all this is going on, the main minister in question is also having to deal with constituency issues.
Yeah, absolutely.
Someone's got a wall which is falling down, and that is just perfect.
It's the best summation of the sort of madness and brilliance of British parliamentary system that I think I've ever seen in any sort of form of drama. Literally, I think I was at one point having sort of two phones on the go. One is, you know, the Pentagon, while he's in the hall, a sort of village hall with someone with some local neighbour boundary dispute to be resolved. I have to say, I've recently started re-watching The Thick of It from the beginning, again, because frankly, we've got the time. I know this is an original observation, but it is so good, and I think people remember the sort of standout moments of it. It is so worth going back and watching it from the very beginning, because there's so much more in it than I remembered. And even though it's quite a long time ago now it first started, it's still so relevant. And the scene when the minister is going to make an announcement and he can't make the announcement, so he has to try and come up with something else, has all the hallmarks of every sort of brainstorming session that's ever happened in politics, even to this day.
And I remember that scene because a lot of the things they brainstorm have since been mooted as real policies. So
yeah, there were loads.
Like carrying a plastic bag. Well, we all
carrying
do
a plastic
that
bag. Something to do, animals in zoos.
Yeah, the spare room database.
Exactly. They're all there and they've all ended up happening in real life. So I thoroughly recommend going back to watch The Thick of It. And In the Loop is Esther Weber's recommendation. Up next, we speak to Kevin Mayer, The Times' chief film critic, and he'll talk us through all of the other films we should and shouldn't be watching.
Off Air, the podcast with Jane Garvey and Fee Glover.
I go to the sink and I have some cheese.
You eat cheese in the sink?
Doesn't everybody?
Every Monday to Thursday, Jane and Fee keep the microphones on after their Times radio show.
I think if we were to do a Mr. and Mrs.
Oh, no.
How would that go in the booth?
Badly. It would go very badly.
Unencumbered and off air.
Two tiny women with gobs.
Off Air, the podcast. Now available on the Times radio app.
So who better to discuss political films with than The Times' chief film critic, Kevin Mayer. Kevin, thank you for joining us.
No problem. Happy to be here, Matt.
So I put out this appeal on Twitter asking, and in the Red Box morning email, asking them to recommend their favourite political films. More than 700 entries. Shall I just talk you through the top 10 first of all?
Yeah, fire ahead, yeah.
Just as an immediate test, just give us a one or two word review of these, you know. Good or bad. In 11th place was Dr. Strangelove.
Hilarious.
9th was The Death of Stalin.
Oh, meaty and deadpan. Perspicacious.
Excellent. 8, Election, which is the Reese Witherspoon one.
Riot.
The Candidate.
Charming, sexy, and yes, political.
Perfect. 13 Days.
Oh, I love 13 Days. Just an unexpected delight. But but a clenchingly exciting too.
And then finally, we're into the top five now. So In the Loop.
in the loop, obviously. You always knew it was going to be good. Iannucci at his best.
Excellent. Number four was Wag the Dog.
Underappreciated classic, although the fact that it's number four suggests it's not underappreciated.
Yeah, it's not underappreciated by the nerds who follow me on Twitter. Number three was Primary Colors.
Probably Colors, slightly disappointing because I felt it was defanged by the fact that it wasn't explicitly, literally about Bill Clinton.
Oh, fine. So it was too subtle. In number two, The Ides of March, which is obviously two versions of that that people could have been referring to.
Yes, I'm imagining they're going for the Gosling Clooney version, which is lovely, witty, and teethy.
And finally, the standout winner, miles ahead of all the others, was All the President's Men.
Yeah, you know, it's the definitive political film. When you said to me, think of political films, I was trying to be sort of pretentious and filming. Oh yeah, the Battle of Algiers is obviously my favorite, but obviously the one that's screaming you in the face is All the President's Men. It's just, I think it's the bar is set by that film.
Now I'm gonna put forward a slightly controversial view that it's not really a political film. It's a really, really good film about journalism.
Yes, no, that's totally true. The truism in all this is that the best political films aren't necessarily about politics. You know, they're tangentially about politics.
The thing that struck me about the top 10, and actually if you go right down through the list, the films which are more straightforwardly about politics, so, you know, your Darkest Hour, Iron Lady, Lincoln, that sort of stuff, you know, but essentially biopics, JFK, films about actual politicians, are less popular than those that are slightly, you know, more one step removed.
Yes, no, this is the complete truth. Films that are sort of handcuffed to very familiar reality are often less interesting. You know, the films that have the latitude to go off and do something unexpected, and maybe films that adhere more to storytelling and drama are more engaging than the films that, oh God, we have to trawl through Nixon's life, we have to do Lincoln, we have to do Malcolm X. You know, these aren't the most interesting films. The ones that are, you know, based on stories that we have a sort of vague notion of, but the filmmakers have freedom to sort of wiggle about dramatically, I think they're the ones that often work the best. You know, my favorite political films are films like Syriana, you know, which clearly aren't based on real life, but kind of are.
Just outside the top 10 was Vice, which is about a real person. It's about Dick Cheney, but that's someone that certainly people in the UK probably didn't know a lot about. So it's not as wedded to somebody doing an impression of George W. Bush and that sort of thing.
I love Vice. A lot of Vice was sort of Marmite movie. I met Adam McKay who made it and co-wrote it, and he stands by and says it's the most factually accurate. You know, that they had to have fact checkers on practically every scene in the film. So it's a weird hybrid where it seems so random, so many bits talking to camera, you know, so sort of off the cuff and yet completely based in truth. And I thought it, again, I think people were vaguely familiar with Dick Cheney. He wasn't like a totally, you know, random celeb that they knew nothing about.
One that also came up an awful lot, and in fact, while we're speaking, I'm still getting emails from about Foss Nixon, which again, although clearly about a real politician and about politics, but I think the reason people like it is because it's about the journalism.
Yeah, it's a journal, but it's also a great dramatic head-to-head. You know, it's the USP is just two big actors or two big characters facing off together. It's a double two-hander. So I think all these films work when they've got something that isn't just hewing to the facts. You know, there's a film that came out recently, Official Secrets, about GCHQ, and you could watch that film and just feel how it wanted to go in one direction. It wanted to be a courtroom thriller, and yet it had to stick to the facts of what really happened in that case, and it was really dull because of it. So yeah, a film like Frost Nixon is just beautifully written by Peter Morgan and a nice series of exchanges with real sort of dramatic jeopardy.
Do you think it helps if you are doing a sort of real life political story, there's a bit of distance in time that actually doing a film that The Deal came up a few times, which is the Gordon Brown Tony Blair thing. You know, if it's all a bit too, if you spend too much time thinking, well, that's not a very good impression of Tony Blair, well, I'm not sure that totally happened, well, that's not, those curtains aren't right, and all that sort of stuff, you don't lose yourself. If there is a bit of distance in time, as you had with Frost Nixon, you can sort of relax into it a bit more rather than I mean, certainly my problem with any film set in the House of Commons is I keep thinking, well, that's not quite right.
Yes, you were totally right. It's very distracting to see somebody from the recent past. Even the special relationship with Tony Blair and Bill Clinton, I found that quite difficult to watch. You know, it's you basically with, I think with any movie, you don't fundamentally want to be snapped out of it with thoughts in your head about, oh, that really doesn't look like, although George W. Bush, you know, Josh Brolin as W, I think he was strong enough for you to forget that it wasn't George W. Bush pretty soon into that movie.
And what about, there were quite a lot of people recommended things which weren't politics in the sense of men in suits marched around shouting at each other, but are clearly political. So Milk came up an awful lot. Sean Penn playing the Harvey Milk.
Yes.
Clearly politics.
Yeah, well, they are, you know, films like Milk is political, Argo is political, obviously 13 Days with the Cuban Missile Crisis. You know, they aren't biopics, they don't feature the heavy hitters that we think of in terms of political, you know, ideas and political narratives, but they definitely are political. In fact, I'd go further, you know, my favorite political films are like High Noon, Invasion of the Body Snatchers, you know, they... I love watching a film and feeling the politics seeping through it without it being explicitly political. You know, Invasion of the Body Snatchers, it's either about conformism or commies. You know, High Noon is about political dissent, you know, and yet one's a Western, one's a sci-fi movie, yet they're deeply satisfying as political films.
Yeah, several people have suggested Planet of the Apes and Star Wars as being political. I mean, I have a strong view on Star Wars being essentially films for children, and I don't want to watch them. One of the ones that nobody's mentioned, but I think I when I watched it, I felt the politics in it, was Zootropolis, which I know is a children's cartoon.
Wow. that must have been a slow news day. Zootropolis. Wow. Okay. That is. But then again, I don't know that, you know, there's arguments that everything is political, obviously.
Yeah, that's
true. In
terms
of movies, is it maintaining the status quo or deconstructing it? So Zootropolis, it's like a country bumpkin animal becomes a super cop, isn't it? Sorry,
yeah,
remind me.
But then there's a sort of everyone becoming very suspicious, and the debate, it turns out there's a mayor who's, or it's not a mayor, it's someone else who's a sort of evil genius who's trying to play people off against each other. I remember just thinking there was the message from it was more political than you, or more, there was more of a message than you sometimes get from kids' cartoons.
Isn't that really distracting though? I found that with sort of watching WALL-E, you know, the Pixar movie, where you know, all the human beings had become morbidly obese because they were sitting on the chairs watching screens. I find that distracting, especially when I'm watching a kids' film, and I go, "God, here comes the politics." You know,
yeah, you're
even
right.
Even the what was it, the Phantom Menace? Remember that? You know, the Star Wars prequels. They start with a big crawl, the crawl at the start. You know, trade wars and people, you know, companies were being overtaxed, and they had banded together to start a trade federation. And always really annoying when you feel that no one, they're not doing storytelling first. You know, there's a message.
Yeah. No, I mean, in fact, a couple of people did suggest Phantom Menace. But yeah, the idea of watching a film and that being about trade deals, that just sounds quite a lot like work to me.
Yes.
The other one that it really sticks in my mind, and partly it's because I watched it on a plane flying to Washington, was Jackie, which is
right,
a very political film in that it's all about Jackie Kennedy. And we were lucky enough, when we got to Washington, we managed to get a tour of the White House. We ended up seeing all the rooms that she did up. But I mean, essentially, I suppose it's not really a political film. It's just a film about a woman who was married to a politician who happened to live in the White House.
Jackie, that's a real left field one. That was kind of trippy, though, that movie. It seemed to do everything. It seemed to be a sort of internal character portrait, as they say, rather than a film that wanted to. I think they sort of readdress the idea that maybe she was more powerful than we thought, and she was, you know, she was more of a player than people actually took her for. But my memories of that film were just thinking it was quite sort of internalized and trippy, and sort of trying to articulate her grief state rather than, you know, giving us a real juicy political look inside the White House.
So of all the ones that we've talked about, if someone was thinking this weekend, or basically at any time now, because we're all stuck at home, what would be your sort of top three political films that people should have watched if they haven't already? And I suspect it'll turn out I haven't watched them.
No. I feel really boring and conventional, but I have to say Wag the Dog, for me, is up there. You have to watch Wag the Dog.
I've not seen Wag the Dog, so this is going on my list.
Okay, good. No, it's so good. It's just, it's I think it was like 1999 or 96, and it's weirdly prescient. It's kind of about fake news, you know. The president is having an affair, and it's, I think, 9 days left of the election, and it's what can we do to distract the public? And so they make a fake war in Albania, and it's co-written by David Mamet, and it's just so wicked and so sharp about, you know, the end game of politics and what people will do to get there. So it's I adore that film.
That feels quite on the money at the moment.
Indeed, yes. Obviously, you know, In the Loop. And I feel like most people have seen In the Loop.
Yeah. If you're remotely interested in politics, you haven't seen In the Loop, then you're not doing it properly.
It'd be nice to go a bit left field. You know, not always straight down the middle. I'll go completely out there with you know, try The Battle of Algiers.
Okay.
You know, the film about the Algerian War. I think it's 1969. It's a film, fact nerds like, is that it was shown to the Pentagon in 2003 before the invasion of Iraq, you know, to prepare them for sort of, you know, counterinsurgency and what happens when an army goes in, you know, and faces terrorism on the streets of a city. So I think it still stands up today. It's, you know, it is black and white. It's obviously it's not an English political movie about the White House, but it's potent stuff.
That all sounds like excellent advice. And anything that we've been talking about that was best avoided? Anything that's particularly stinky?
You know, this sounds pretty harsh, but I avoid all the biopics. Okay. They're either compromised by the maker's love or hate of the subject, and they end up like a Wikipedia page having to hit certain biographical beats that make for really dull viewing. You know, I know people like Nixon, you know, JFK, even JFK is lucky because it hinges around a court case, and that's always more interesting. But even Lincoln was a bit of a troll. So, and the Iron Lady again, you know, the Iron Lady was made not really about Thatcher. It was sort of, neo-feminist slant on what Thatcher actually did. And again, I think steer clear of the biopic, steer clear of anything that has to articulate too many facts. You just want something that's, a compulsive story with political mood.
Having told us to steer clear of the biopics, I was about to ask you who you thought had been the best Churchill, because he's probably been the most projected portrayed.
No, that's a good note. I'd like to think it was Gary Oldman for Darkest Hour, but part of me can't help but feel that performance was aided so much by the look and by the prosthetics, the Oscar-winning prosthetics, that I really admired Brian Cox's Churchill from 2017. No makeup, you know, there was no attempt, you know, to sort of visually disguise him, but it was a low budget movie. They didn't have any of the whistles and bells, but he sort of seemed to capture something.
Just finally, before I let you go, what on earth is happening in the world of film? How are you doing your job?
Well, so far, amazingly, a lot of distribution companies are chucking stuff online, streaming it. So they're all, at the moment, we're in this weird space where a lot of them are art house movies, small movies, who don't have a lot to gamble. And they're putting them on places like Curzon Home Cinema. And so streaming independent films. So, you know, every week there's a huge Hollywood movie, maybe a not so huge Hollywood movie, and a load of independent movies. And what's happening at the moment, it seems, is most of the independent movies are going for streaming services. And the big Hollywood movies are playing a waiting game. Some of them, like there's a kids film called Trolls, Trolls World Tour. They're going to put that out streaming next week. Some of the movies who have just hit cinemas just before the lockdown started, they're going streaming. There's a Vin Diesel movie called Bloodshot that's been put on streaming. The Invisible Man update, that's been put on streaming. So my feeling is that the really huge movies like Marvel's Black Widow, they're just going to sit tight like Bond and wait till either the very end of the summer or maybe even autumn before they go out, because they need to go out theatrically. They need to go out around the globe. They need to make, you know, upwards of $1 billion to make their money back, because they're so expensive. And you just at the moment can't guarantee that from streaming services.
Well, because also presumably you can't charge £8, £10, £12 per person to watch it.
Well, bizarrely, the independents, last week, Catherine Deneuve, Juliette Binoche film called The Truth came out. That was kind of prestige movie that was in Venice last year. And that'll cost you $11.99 to watch it on your TV or on your iPad. So the pricing is, let's say, you know, euphemistically competitive, to say the least. So
Exit Kevin, there's loads of stuff, loads of good stuff for people to get their teeth and streaming services stuck into over the coming days and weeks and months. Who knows? Kevin Mayer there. Don't forget, you can vote for your favourite films in the Times Red Box World Cup of Political Films on Twitter on Friday, the 27th of March from 10 a.m. Make sure you subscribe to the podcast and give us a review. Loads of you have, and it's really nice to see all of your comments and let us know where you're listening. Post a review on Apple or wherever you listen. And you can sign up to my morning email so you too can nominate your favourite political films in future. Go to thetimes.co.uk/redbox. But for now, my thanks to Kevin Mayer and Esther Webber. For me, Matt Chorley, it's goodbye.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal: to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.